Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, you remember the trade war? Yeah, us too. There have been some developments. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 18th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Two items with which to begin the program today. One geopolitical, the other a bit more econo-political, if you will. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin announced today that after talking with his boss and with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about the disappearance and likely murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, he is not going to be going to that investment conference in Saudi Arabia after all. No further elaboration from the Treasury Department was forthcoming on that one. So that is the economic slice of today's political news. The econo-political, I think I am coining that phrase officially, by the way, it came from former White House economic advisor Gary Cohn today. He did a whole thing on CNBC, said he is really pleased with the state of the economy overall, except for this one thing.
We are a service economy. Our economy is driven by service. We're 80%+ of our GDP, 80%+ of our job creation is services. So when you're a service economy, the way to stimulate your economy, the way to grow your economy is to allow consumers to buy goods as cheaply as they possibly can and use the rest of their money to buy services or, if they're lucky enough, to save. Anything that raises the price of a good doesn't make sense for our economy. Even if they're paying it to the government as a tariff, it's just another tax.
Although he never did actually come out and say it, it's widely believed Cohn left the White House over the president's decision to go ahead with the trade war that we are in. And that trade war, by the way, does seem to be picking up a little bit of steam. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross was in Brussels this week talking things over with the European Commission. And you might recall back in July, the president agreed to hold off on his threat to hit European auto imports with tariffs. That would have been a very, very big deal. The president agreed to hold off while the two sides negotiated a bigger trade deal. Well, 3 months later, both sides are now blaming the other for lack of progress on any discussions, with Ross saying, quote, our president's patience is not unlimited. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the transatlantic latest.
Back in late July, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker and President Trump stood side by side in the Rose Garden and announced the makings of a deal.
We agreed today, first of all, to work together towards zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies on non-auto industrial goods. Thank you.
So what's the holdup? Finance professor Jeffrey Bergstrand at the University of Notre Dame says, for one thing, U.S. trade officials have been a little busy hammering out another deal to replace NAFTA, and that involved just three countries.
When you take that to 28 countries in the European Union, it's a very demanding procedure, demands a lot of time.
And Michelle Egan, a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, says some of those non-tariff barriers, like differing regulations and industry standards, are hard to resolve.
There are differences in regulations on cosmetics, for example, because of animal testing, differences in the way cars are tested in terms of safety lights or seat belts.
And then there are the politics, says Charles Kupchan, professor of international affairs at Georgetown. He says in Europe, growing anti-Trump and anti-American sentiment could be another roadblock.
And on this side of the Atlantic, you've got a protectionist president who is none too keen on striking a deal with the EU because he sees it as a foe that has been seeking to take advantage of the United States.
On the other hand, Kupchan says the Trump administration has a big incentive to forge a deal to put pressure on its bigger trade target, China. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So that's trade. The early part of this week, economic news-wise, was dominated by the budget. Actually, the budget deficit, all $779 billion of it last fiscal year, a 17% increase over the prior year. That was on Monday. And then yesterday, President Trump said he wants to cut 5% from the federal budget next fiscal year. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he is disturbed by the deficit and blames Social Security and Medicare. But here's the thing. A big chunk of the increase in what we are going to owe every year is because the federal government is pulling in less tax revenue thanks to the tax cuts passed last year. Yes, the tax cuts that were going to pay for themselves. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams checks in on how that is going.
So, yeah, despite the rhetoric in the run-up to the passage of the tax law,
the tax cuts were never going to pay for themselves.
Brian Riedel is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and used to work for the Senate Finance Committee.
At this point, there is no real scenario by which the tax cuts pay for themselves. They're probably going to cost about $2 to $2.5 trillion over 10 years.
But let's review that scenario where they do pay for themselves over 10 years. First, you cut corporate taxes, businesses invest, that increases productivity, wages go up, and boom, that magical 3% growth per year we've heard so much about. Arpana Mator at the American Enterprise Institute says it's too early to know what's working.
So I think looking at 1 year's numbers and saying, well, the tax cuts are not working and we're adding to the deficits instead of reducing them, I think is kind of misleading.
Even if things take time, she says, time isn't the only issue. We paid for these tax cuts with debt.
Even in an ideal world where everybody imagines that tax cuts pay for themselves, you know, that theory takes place in a situation where the tax cuts themselves are not deficit financed.
Another wrinkle, companies aren't spending their tax savings the way tax writers planned. Stan Collender is an expert on the federal budget. For example, he says, we've only seen a modest increase in wages. Also,
companies aren't investing. They're using it to pay off debt, and they're using it to pay off stockholders and do a variety of things that don't actually increase economic activity.
And there will need to be a huge boost in economic activity if these tax cuts are ever going to pay for themselves. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The activity on Wall Street today was down a lot, but that is what is supposed to happen every now and then, y'all. It is supposed to happen. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A cynical observer would say that, of course, there wasn't going to be a Brexit deal between Britain and the European Union at that big meeting that wrapped up in Brussels today. The talks to date, and remember, it's been almost 2.5 years since the British vote to leave the European Union, but the talks to date have been a whole lot of back and forth and back and forth and then a little bit more back and forth. But students of EU crises past will know that this is pretty much par for the course. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the update.
This was supposed to be a climactic moment when EU leaders finally gave their blessing to Britain's exit deal. But the chief EU negotiator, Michel Barnier, let the air out of the balloon at a news conference after the summit.
We'll continue to work in the next weeks calmly and patiently. Calmly and patiently.
And when the president of the European Parliament, Antonio Tajani, was asked for his assessment of the summit, this was the best he could do.
I want to be optimistic. The body language was more positive than in the past.
Clearly, there was no breakthrough. The problem, as ever, the so-called Irish backstop. Ireland and the rest of the EU insist on a permanent, legally binding commitment preventing a hard border between the British province of Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. In effect, says Eurosceptic member of the European Parliament, David Campbell Bannerman, that could trap the UK permanently under EU control.
If we get stuck in the customs union, if we give the EU a veto so they can keep us in the customs union, if they don't give us a deal, we stay in the customs union. That's what the backstop does.
Prime Minister May has now tried to break the impasse by proposing to extend the 21-month period of transition out of the EU after the formal exit next March. This, she says, would give both sides more time to negotiate a full-blown free trade deal, which would make the Irish backstop unnecessary. But James Crisp, Brussels correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, says a longer transition period is not an easy option. He says the UK would have
no voice in the European Parliament, no representation in the European Commission. We've undertaken basically to accept any regulations which come down the track from the Commission. It's a real limbo.
And that, he says, could turn into a real purgatory, lasting as long as a decade and costing the UK tens of billions in extra payments to the EU. Britain now has a little over 5 months before its EU membership expires. 5 months to strike an exit deal and have it ratified. Peter Ricketts, former UK ambassador to France, says the prospect of no deal should focus the minds of negotiators.
When people look into the abyss of no deal, they're going to see that it's really terrible for all sides, including the EU, and therefore we've got to find some pragmatic way of getting a deal, buying some more time before we sort out the final relationship.
The only crumb of comfort in this mess is that missed deadlines, 11th-hour ultimata, and emergency meetings on the eve of disaster are an EU speciality. Remember the Greek debt crisis? Situation normal, one might say. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is out with the latest version of our poll this week, the Marketplace Edison Research Economic Survey. And as I mentioned yesterday, the headline numbers do show a pretty good level of optimism about the economy overall, as well as personal financial security, but not for everyone. Our poll shows more African Americans than whites say they are worried a recession is coming, and twice as many African Americans as whites believe that next recession is going to hit them. Which makes sense, because the last recession hit blacks harder and many still haven't completely recovered. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
The Great Recession was hard on Nicole Jones of Indianapolis. In 2008, the year the financial crisis hit, she was laid off from her longtime job as a property claims adjuster. Then, to make matters worse, she received a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. So when asked if she fears another recession...
Yes.
Today, Nicole Jones remains unemployed and collects disability through Social Security. And she's still asking herself a lot of the same questions she did 10 years ago.
Should we go to the doctor for this or should we not? Or do we really need this medication or can we get by on another medication or do we just not get it at all?
The poll's economic anxiety index is as low as it's ever been overall, but more than two-thirds of African Americans say they fear a recession coming in the next year. That's 51% for Hispanics and 49% for whites. And more African Americans than whites worry a recession will affect them. Not surprising, says economist Valerie Wilson with the Economic Policy Institute. During the last recession, the unemployment rate for blacks was twice that of whites, and losses in median household income were higher.
By nearly all of the standards that we would use to gauge a family's economic security and economic well-being, Black and Hispanic families were definitely hit much harder by the Great Recession.
And their recovery has been slower. In the poll, 40% of African Americans said it'd be difficult to pay an unexpected expense of $1,000, almost double the 21% of whites who say that. That may be because...
there's this huge racial wealth gap.
Marsha Baradaran is a banking law professor at the University of Georgia.
When you have communities that have less wealth, so greater poverty, they're much more vulnerable to any sort of recession, shock to the economy at all. They're the first to lose their jobs. They're the first to lose their homes. They're the last to recover.
Today, Nicole Jones and her husband are making do on her disability checks and his $60,000 a year salary. They have two daughters in college and high health care bills. And while the economy may be doing well overall, Jones says,
right now, we haven't added to our savings account in the past almost year now.
And she's not sure when she will again. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
There is plenty more data from our poll and what it might mean for the midterms that you can dig into on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM, a new number every day till Election Day. Coming up.
They've just lost these trees that had grown over, honestly, a century.
Picking up the economic pieces after a hurricane. But first, let's do the numbers. This is like, what, 3 days out of the last six for the Wawas, right? Dow Industrial's off 327 points today, 1.2%, closed at 25,379. NASDAQ down 2%, 157 points, 74.85. S&P 500 down 40 points, 1.4%, 27.68. Sealed Air is a pretty good example of the kind of stock getting hammered as markets fret over things like the trade war and higher borrowing costs and wage pressures. The maker of Cryovac food packaging and bubble wrap also got crushed 8.3% today. Sealed cut its profit forecast because of higher raw material and shipping costs. Tool and equipment maker Snap-on sank 9.6% today after a disappointing earnings report. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.17%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is peak season for the professional sports fans among you, the one time of the year when all five men's, yes, men's professional sports are in action. There are games tonight from MLB, Major League Soccer, the NBA, the NHL, and the NFL. I saw it called the Sports Equinox online today. Funnily enough, tonight is the first time that's happened since the Supreme Court decided back in May that sports gambling is legal all over the country. Bookmakers are looking at a potential market upwards of $70 billion a year. And sports being a business, the various leagues want a slice of that straight-up gambling pie. But they are going to benefit anyway, even if they don't get it. That's according to a new report commissioned by a trade group for the gambling industry, rather the gaming industry. Marketplace's Mario Segura looks at what the payout is likely to be.
It all comes down to this. With legal sports betting, there's a big old pile of money at stake. The gambling industry says legalization is going to generate more than $4 billion in additional revenue for the big sports leagues. Jeremy Duru teaches sports law at American University.
It will drive more people to watch, whether it's buying tickets to games, whether it's watching games, and then because somebody on the team they were pulling for because they bet for them scored an important touchdown, they go out and buy the jerseys.
Duru says with more viewers, the leagues will be able to charge more for ads. And Michelle Minton at the Competitive Enterprise Institute says the leagues will get another big chunk of money from gambling sponsorships and advertising.
And this is enormous because throughout the world, gambling interests are among the largest sponsors of sport. So, and in the U.S., they really couldn't engage in that kind of behavior because gambling on sports was illegal.
But here's the thing. This report was commissioned by the American Gaming Association. It's a gambling industry trade group. They want to make legal betting look like a good deal for the leagues. So Jeremy Duru at American University says, yeah, grain of salt.
But even with the grain of salt, you're going to end up getting really substantial increases in revenue.
The leagues want more. They want a cut of the betting action. Recently, an MLB official said 0.25% sounds about right. Stefan Szymański at the University of Michigan says the bookies say that's unnecessary.
They're arguing that, in fact, the sports authorities will gain anyway because of the indirect benefits that will be derived.
Legal sports betting is already happening in 6 states, and it's on the way in 3 more. I'm Marielle Segura for Marketplace.
Uber and Lyft already compete in a whole lot of ways, right? Ride sharing, bike sharing, they do e-scooters as well. And come next year, they are going to be competing for investors, too. Both companies are said to be planning initial public offerings early in 2019. Both companies also currently lose a whole lot of money. So we had Marketplace's Emma Jacobs look into how that might play out with their share offering.
For years, Uber and Lyft have subsidized rides to keep costs low for customers. That fueled their growth, which in turn fueled their expected valuations, as much as $120 billion for Uber and $20 billion or more for Lyft. But those subsidies mean neither company is profitable.
Frankly, it'll probably be a
fairly long road before they are.
So, says Jeff Schuster, auto analyst at LMC Automotive, the hype around these IPOs
has to be about, you know, the prospects for a very different model for the future.
A model in which fewer people own their own cars and instead rely on a range of on-demand transportation options, especially self-driving vehicles. If there are no drivers, Uber and Lyft don't have to pay any drivers. That goal's a long way off. So according to Susan Shaheen at the University of California, Berkeley, both companies have begun offering pooled rides, scooters, and bikes. Some of these services are profitable, but all of them help wean people from their own cars.
What you're seeing is these incremental approaches to get us there while we ready ourselves for automation.
Uber and Lyft's IPOs will give them more capital to invest in developing driverless cars. And Kathy Smith of Renaissance Capital says whichever company is first to market is likely to benefit from investor enthusiasm.
Scarcity value can be something important, so the first one may actually be the most well-received one.
In other words, raising more money while sucking up some of the others' momentum. I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
Lawmakers in North Carolina approved an $850 million hurricane relief spending plan this week. Not for Michael, the most recent of the storms to hit that state and the greater southeast. This money is for damage from Florence, which hit a month ago. It killed 40 people, left behind an estimated $13 billion in damage. The cleanup is still going on, but it's going slowly because there is a limited pool of cleanup workers. Marketplace's Andy Euler in Wilmington, North Carolina, has that one.
Wilmington is a tourist town on the southeastern coast of North Carolina, and almost everyone winds up on Market Street. It's the main drag that gets you downtown and onto the boardwalk along the Cape Fear River. 14-year resident Katrina Knight says Market Street just isn't the same since Florence.
So often when people come into our community, you know, it's just these huge live oaks on either side. So much of them have been lost now that this beautiful old home that you could barely see before now is clearly in view, but because they've just lost these trees that had grown over, honestly, a century.
Today, if you drive down Market Street, both sides of the road are lined with huge tree trunks cut down by tree-trimming businesses. There's plenty of work for them to do. Weeks after the storm, some roads are still blocked by huge fallen trees. Randy Campbell's hauling away truckfuls of tree limbs and dirt just off of Market Street. He's in town from Haleyville, Alabama, more than 600 miles away. He and his five-man crew got here soon after Florence to get started on the cleanup.
You do the FEMA storms, the big disasters, help come in and clean up all the debris and everything.
Campbell owns and operates his own trucking firm. He's got multiple dump trucks on site to haul debris to local landfills. He says even though his business profits from this kind of destruction, he always prays the storms don't hit.
This is heart-wrenching, you know. We just come in and help clean it up and make some money doing it. But, you know, you got to be able to do that to be able to pay for the equipment and the fuel and the lodging and getting back and forth. It's very expensive.
He says it cost about $10,000 for him to get one of his dump trucks here. He's working for a contractor who gets paid by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He says the damage is massive and the laborers are few.
The competition for a contractor will be severe. And there's already people pulling out of here, hauling their equipment and headed to Florida,
where Hurricane Michael struck. The fresher the disaster, the higher the price for this kind of work, Campbell says. But that means the cleanup in North Carolina will probably take longer than it otherwise would, as many crews chase the dollars. Campbell says he and his crew will likely stay on in Wilmington until at least Thanksgiving, maybe even Christmas.
We're helping this community. There was a lady told me the other day she could not get out of her driveway without risking her life. The rats in these piles of snakes, we got a 13-foot python out of a pile of brush.
For folks in North Carolina, cleanup and relief can't come quick enough. Right now, some 28,000 homeowners and renters in the state are receiving some kind of assistance from FEMA. About 1,300 are getting FEMA vouchers to live in hotels. Wilmington resident Katrina Knight is still able to live in her home. She says she was lucky to escape with minimal storm damage. Her neighbor's home didn't fare so well.
What was a beautiful tree in front of it as it came down just came
right smack down the middle of it, and you can no longer tell what color the house was. I mean, it is just the whole front of it is gone, and I'm sure that that family is working hard to recover.
Knight says some of her friends lost everything and don't have much by way of insurance. But she doesn't know anybody who's seriously thinking of leaving Wilmington just to get out of harm's way, for now.
I mean, how far do you go? If what they say is accurate, that we'll be experiencing more hurricanes and perhaps more hurricanes on the order of a Florence, I think that's where it begins to change.
Florence made landfall as a Category 1 hurricane, which doesn't sound that bad. But the storm dumped more than 3 feet of rain on much of North Carolina. Extraordinary? Sure. But more and more folks here say they fear such events are becoming the new normal. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. You know how open plan offices are all the rage? No more isolating cubicles, just low-rise separators? Well, that can be a tricky environment, right? Lots of distractions, tough to concentrate. You could put in your earbuds, or you could try this new thing that Panasonic is working on, and this is real, I kid you not. It's called Wear Space, W-E-A-R Space. And the only way I can think to describe it is like those blinders that horses wear, except for people, wraps all the way around your head, cuts off your hearing, and 60% of your peripheral vision, Panasonic says. All right, we got to go. Lousy on Wall Street is the way I'm going to leave it today. But I'm also going to leave it by saying this, which I said before. That is the way it is supposed to work. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.